A few years ago, when trying to buy a house, I focused my search on Dublin's north inner city. I viewed homes on Bayview Avenue, Hawthorne Terrace, St Mary's Road. Despite stretching my budget as far as I could, I was outbid for a beautiful Victorian on St Bridget's Avenue. But it was when I visited a two-up, two-down on Emerald Street that my gran became really interested. "That's our area," she said. Gran, whose name was Alvina, grew up on nearby Common Street and left school at 14 to start as a dressmaker, working in her boss's Emerald Street bedroom. Gran liked the idea that I might end up back where she began, inhabiting her section of the city. I did too, but I didn't get the house on Emerald Street either. Gran's father and her older brother Seamus worked at the docks until they died tragically within a year of each other, when Gran was just 20. Seamus, just 29, fell from the lorry on which he was hitching a lift home from the Point. Gran's husband Billy, from St Lawrence's Mansions on nearby Sheriff Street, also worked initially as a docker, and later for the British and Irish Steam Packet Company, known as the B&I. Like many dockworkers, Billy was a staunch trade unionist. Billy and Alvina's Dublin was a city deeply bound up with its port. There's a French author I like called Georges Perec. In his 1974 work, Species of Spaces, he writes, "I am a man of the towns. I was born, I grew up, and I have lived in towns. My habits, my rhythms, and my vocabulary are the habits, rhythms, and vocabulary of a townsman. In the same way, my grandparents were of the North Docks. The docks shaped their rhythms and their habits, their politics, and their bereavements." I've recently been researching the buildings my grandparents grew up in as part of a longer form project I'm developing with Arts Council support. St Lawrence's Mansions, where Billy lived when he met Alvina, were built in the 1940s as part of the New States drive to house its people. The Medical Officer of Health had condemned sections of Dublin's tenements and cottages as unfit for human habitation, and these clearance areas were demolished to make way for new housing. St Lawrence's Mansions were part of the Newfoundland Street Scheme, later known as the Sheriff Street Flats, the original design for which was by prolific social housing architect Herbert Sims. Construction didn't begin at Newfoundland Street until Grandad was in his teens. He lived in a house on Mare Street before then, a house I didn't know much about until recently when, at the fantastic Dublin City Archive, I found a letter written by Herbert Sims which refers to the house Grandad was born in as a tenement. So, Billy went from a tenement to a corporation-built flat, then out to a new suburb when he married my gran. The Sheriff Street flats, which feature in Jim Sheridan's film In the Name of the Father, were demolished in 1998. The site is now occupied by Custom House Square and the Spencer Dock Service Departments. So Grandad, who died in 2019, witnessed three entirely different versions of the city block that made him. A few years ago, while working at Neil McLaughlin Architects, I was involved in a project called Losing Myself for the Venice Biennale. The project, a collaboration between Neil and architect Yuriam Manalapulu, was concerned with spatial perception and dementia and involved consultation with experts from all sorts of disciplines. One expert, Kate Jeffrey, a neuroscientist, told us about a kind of map the brain creates of places it knows well. She said that when you go back to a place you've been to before, all the familiar landmarks in their familiar places reawaken memories of the things that happened the last time you were there. Now I think of Billy encountering each transformed version of Mare Street, and I wonder what memories were reawakened in him. Georges Perec writes in Species of Spaces that he would like there to exist places that are stable, unchanging, deep-rooted, places that might be points of reference. But, he concludes, these places don't exist. Perec knows that his spaces are fragile. Time is going to wear them away, to destroy them. He writes, he says, to cause something to survive. The last Christmas before my gran died, we had dinner together at my parents' house. Gran's dementia had progressed by then, and while she remained her gentle, affectionate self, she was unmoored by uncertainty around when and where she was. One way to settle her was to get her talking about the past, about people and things she could remember. We somehow ended up looking at the 1911 census for the North Docks, And though Gran wasn't born at that time, her face brightened as I called out names of neighbours she recognised. She was off then, describing the stable yard at the rear of their common street house. The uncle who'd sent her out to the shops. Next door, her best friends, the Brennans. Around the corner, her Emerald Street boss. Her brother and father waiting for their lift to the docks. And like that, Billy and Alvina's slice of Dublin came back to life. It survives in the maps and the records and the stories.
You're never more conscious of the ferocious power of Irish weather than when crouched in a tent during heavy rainfall. When indoors, we nearly always assume our enclosures are weatherproofed. This confidence disappears in a tent where we can actually feel the weather's onslaught. As the wind swells, sides billow, and percussive rain hammers outside, you beg the precarious shelter, "Please don't fail me." How often do we ask this question of buildings? When the weather wins, do buildings fail us? Author Sinéad O'Toole describes two churches designed by celebrated Irish architect Liam McCormick as metaphorical tents in the wilderness. The churches, Our Lady of Lourdes in Steelstown, Derry, and St. Connell's in Glenties, Donegal, are almost all roof. Their enormous slate sides cascade rainwater into obedient moats without conventional gutters. The churches are defiant, like rock formations washing off the sea, tents made of stone. In the late 1970s, shortly after finishing these two churches, Liam McCormick was designing what was, for him, an anomaly. Not a sculptural chapel embedded in a landscape, but a stone-clad office building in Glasnevin. A pyramid-shaped headquarters for the Irish Meteorological Service, later renamed Met Éireann, opened in 1980. Situated at the summit of Glasnevin Hill, the building surveys Dublin as if from a crow's nest. Just down the road sits another pyramid, Our Lady of Dolores Church, from 1972. These seemingly related edifices prompted writer Frank MacDonald to describe Glasnevin as Dublin's version of the Valley of Kings. It was a time when meteorology was fast changing. The old ways of meticulously observing and recording nature were being made redundant by technology and advanced data analytics. McCormick remained loyal to nature and the seasons. He designed a temple for sky worshippers. It was on one of his many sailing trips in Zurich that Liam first discovered his inspiration for this unusual building. The Pharaoh House, a rusted steel pyramid of offices, designed by Swiss architect Justus de Hinden in 1970. De Hinden, whom McCormick visited, was a kindred architect, the spiritual type. He called his series of diagonally sloped buildings cosmoforms. They took their inspiration from ancient Egyptian and Mesoamerican architecture, monuments that worshipped the sun, moon, and sky. In practical terms, they allowed more natural light inside their rooms and lower levels. A pyramid shape for Met Éireann also meant the building would cast less shadow on its surrounding red brick houses. This unique structure was formed in deference to nature rather than in defiance of it. The forecasters told McCormick, "We like to look at the sky." He tilted the windows of the building with the walls at 23 degrees, the angle of the Earth's tilted axis. These men and women would therefore gaze heavenwards, perhaps like the doomed prisoner in The Ballad of Reading Jail, of whom Oscar Wilde wrote, "I never saw a man who looked with such a wistful eye upon that little tent of blue which prisoners call the sky, and at every drifting cloud that went with sails of silver by." As the building was being built, scientists were beginning to study a newfound hole in the ozone layer. They too stared at the blue tent in the sky, begging it not to fail. Disaster struck in Glasnevin in the summer of 1988, when the stone panels started to peel off the building. One observer memorably likened them to curled up stale sandwiches. We now know that the Ballinasloe limestone used was too thin and too porous. It allowed rainwater to trickle into its skin. When the large stone panels could not flex and contract in drying out in the sun, they ripped themselves off the building. The Irish weather was attacking the institution dedicated to it. Is marig a bocher in am an anfa, mar togan an crin in ní na farana. Pity the person who drowns in the storm, for the sun always follows the rain. So reads the prophetic proverb inscribed by artist Ruth Brandt in the building's lobby. While the events were certainly a source of embarrassment for some, McCormick was unperturbed. He had reluctantly used limestone. His original choice was for Welsh slate. Protestations in the Dáil about using non-Irish materials on public jobs had led to a late change of cladding, during what was already a stressful and complicated build. At that point, only a thin outer layer was possible. No chances were taken on a replacement material in the 1990s. Blue aluminium panels were designed and installed without McCormick's involvement. As a result of its new skin, most Dubliners today compare Met Éireann to a space station, not an ancient temple, an image helped by the clusters of satellite dishes projecting from its roof. During the recladding debacle, artist Robert Balla happened to be commissioned to paint a portrait of McCormick for the Ulster Museum. McCormick would sadly not live to see the final painting. Imposing, he insisted on grasping a scale model of Met Éireann, despite his church's greater renown. In Balla's depiction, Liam sits at his desk, carefully pressing the model with both hands towards his breast, as he gazes off at the horizon with a wistful eye. Clearly, the building didn't fail him.
Someone once told me that Dublin is a city of houses, and that most of what matters to people is happening behind closed doors. I often think of these words as I walk through the city to work, passing row after row, street after street, of red brick houses and homes. Houses, the most private of things, in fact tell the most publicly valuable tales. We are what we build, and houses hold hidden history like no other buildings I know. This year, one of the most famous houses ever designed and built, the Reidfell Schroeder House, is 100 years old. Located at the end of the long leafy terraces of Prince Heinrichlaan in the Dutch city of Utrecht, I recently visited the house again for my first time in 30 years. In terms of floor area, the house is modest, the size of a typical Irish semi-D, but it is now a World Heritage Site due to its importance not only to architecture and culture, but as UNESCO confirmed, to humanity itself. The Reidfell Schroeder House was a collaboration between designer Gerrit Reidfell and owner True Schroeder. As one of the only built examples of the radical ideas of the De Stael group of artists, architects and designers, active in the Netherlands between 1917 and 31, and to which Reidfell belonged, the house became a kind of mascot for that movement, and thus both notorious and influential. De Stael was founded by painters Theo van Doesburg and Piet Mondrian as a reaction to the horrors of World War I and with the firm belief that they could transform a world destroyed by war into a new utopia, with architecture harnessing the unity of all the arts, engineering and industry towards some social and spiritual redemption. As I approached this house last August, so familiar to me as an architect, I was surprised, even taken aback. With its crisp grey and white floating wall panels, accents of black steel and saturated primary colours of blue, red and yellow, with three front doors, and with corner windows that hinge outwards with no structural supports, this house still appears out of this world. Indeed, the two-storey house with the very flat roof could not have been more different than the sober three-storey pitched roof brick-terraced houses, on the gables of which it's squarely built. I imagine when the scaffold came down 100 years ago, the house must truly have looked like it landed from outer space. Back in 1924, when the house was completed, many in Utrecht saw it as an affront to tradition, pelting it with tomatoes. The house was so unusual that True Schroeder's daughter dared not tell her school friends that that weird house, as it was nicknamed, was actually her family home. Schroeder's desire for commissioning this weird house was propelled by grief. Widowed in 1923, she once wrote that faced with three children to care for alone, she needed to think deeply about how next they should live. With her life changed forever, she wanted an open house in which she and her children could mourn in the light. She rejected her bourgeois life and the stuffy, dark architecture it required, even asking her children to leave their belongings behind as their new home came into view. Schroeder had met Rietveld briefly in 1911, when he delivered a desk to her husband. And, liking his style, in 1921 she asked him to alter one room in her home, a room that she later recalled as my beautiful room of greys. Led by Schroeder, the pair set about imagining another kind of domestic arrangement altogether, carried out on the first floor, not on the ground, with living and sleeping in one large space that could flexibly fold into five. Fixed on new horizons, Schroeder wanted the air, the light, and the view of the Polder landscape to be always present indoors. It was she who determined that a boundary between inside and out might dissolve via massive hinged windows, and she who wanted her children close by as they played, as she worked, as they grew up and old together. When an enthusiastic Rietveld presented the first, quite typical, sketch for a house full of rooms to Schroeder, it was firmly rejected. "Can't we get rid of the walls?" she asked, to which Rietveld replied, "With pleasure, away with the walls." Such ideas may seem commonplace now, but they were extraordinary then. Schroeder lived in the house until her death in 1985. She and Rietveld had fallen in love, but it was only when his wife died in 1957 that he moved in with Schroeder. The couple united in the house they designed together until his death in 1964. Neither had originally trained as an architect, but the pair worked downstairs, designing together, among other things, two public housing blocks nearby. When I was a student, I was in awe of the design brilliance of this house. I still am, but 30 years on, with age and experience of love, grief, and making a home with another, I understand now that having a house is a precious freedom. On that sunny Saturday tour, I spot a small portrait of Rietveld taped to a blue wall, while to an audience of visitors, a smiling, white-gloved guide is now performing the act of first closing, then opening the flexible folding partitions and doors in the collapsible, colourful upstairs room for which this house is world-renowned. As the light is pushed out and drawn in again, it's as if the house itself is a pulsing, breathing, living thing. The room rumbles as partitions roll, and I can almost hear them laugh, giddy together in love and in thrall of the open house. Away with the walls, away with the walls.
In the last few years, I've lived in hotels, friends' houses, and a homeless shelter here in Ireland. I have seen things in Ireland from a few perspectives and met people from many walks of Irish life. Here are two examples. One good, one not so good, but in reverse order so we end on a happy note. This first story is from 2015. It was raining, pouring. Most people were either snoring or preparing to try. I was in a town in the west of the country, but had nowhere dry to sleep for the night. I walked down a path from the main town until I saw a large house that was surrounded by a new and expensive-looking grey wall. The property had a couple of outbuildings that I thought were probably for cars or storage, garden equipment or similar. The main gate wasn't locked, so I sleekly nudged my way through it and walked up the path to the furthest outbuilding from the house. Unfortunately, the door to the outbuilding was locked, so I put down my bag and sat under the shelter of the door overhang. I had been relaxing for a few minutes, as best as I could after a long day travelling, mostly on foot, when the front door of the house opened and a man with a dog on a leash approached me. Now, I understand how this person had no idea if I was a friend or foe. All he knew was I was an intruder to his property. And as he and his animal walked towards me, I said, "Hello, I'm sorry for being here, but I just had to get some shelter from the rain. I'm on my way to Mayo, but I've nowhere to stay for the night. I'm sorry for disturbing you. I'll leave." What, dear listener, would you have done if you were in this man's position? Anyway, he told me to leave immediately or he would let the dog loose. So off I went into the cold, wet night. I walked back to the main street, huddled in the doorway, and wrote this poem. "I'm nobody and I'm nothing. Tonight I am unseen. Tomorrow I'll be nowhere, and your conscience will be clean." I found my way to my late mother's birthplace in Mayo the following day. She had died when I was a teenager, but every few years I try to get back to Ballinar, where she grew up, and spend some time in the places she used to know. My second tale is more recent. Although not a religious man, I was rescued from the streets by the St. Vincent de Paul in Wexford. They never asked if I was a believer or not, which was a relief for me. I was given a room and meals in their town centre men's shelter, room 22. The men were mostly rougher and tougher than me. Although brought up on a Manchester council estate, I was lucky to have had Irish parents that made sure I was educated and wise to the world, not just to the street. Our house was full of books and we were encouraged to read them. The St. Vincent de Paul looked after me and within a few weeks found me a place of my own, a small flat to live in, to write and paint in, to laugh and cry in. I'm still here and I wrote this poem. I didn't die yet, so you needn't cry yet. I'm so happy on my own. Let the spring fly into summer's high. Let our winter be alone.
The term Georgian Dublin is shorthand for over a century of urban expansion and architectural development under the reigns of four successive Kings George. In marketing terms, it's a stellar brand, associated with changes in style and taste right up to the advent of Victoriana in 1837. The trademark is so dominant that it eclipses an intriguing moment in our capital's architectural development, a period that spanned the reigns of three monarchs between 1820 and 1850, but may be bound with one in particular, the blip-like tenure of King William IV. A moniker more associated with antique furniture than buildings, it's curious that the William IV period, which only lasted 7 years in regnal terms, has been so overlooked as a style epoch, not least because Dublin exhibits so many of its riches, built in the economic boom to 1845. It is perhaps the devastating full stop of the Great Famine that has overshadowed this prosperous era. The William IV period can be described as much as a mood as a design phase, one of accelerating social change, early globalisation and rapid technological advancement. It triggered a wave of design influences from across the globe, particularly the already established Greek Revival, newer Egyptomania, Italianate and the Gothic Revival. What's so fascinating about this architectural mashup is the adoption of these themes in Dublin often resulted in madly eccentric local interpretations. As one 1840s commentator put it, the present age is distinguished from all others by having no style which can be properly called its own. William IV is a moody teenager with a rolling identity crisis, veering from gloomy to whimsical, aggressive to sedate, and is almost always awkward. The essential spirit of Dublin, immortalised by Strumpet City and bottled by Morris Craig, is not all lofty Georgian, it's also willful William IV, woven through the city's structural DNA. The style essentially dispensed with the Georgian classical canon in favour of a muscular eclecticism that suited a commercialising age. Hallmarks included raw expanses of cut stone, massive pylon piers, emphatic channelling, cambered windows and doors, heavily moulded joinery and ironwork, and distinctive motifs like scrolling lotus flowers, honeysuckle and anthemia. The material palette was senatorial and masculine, granite, yellow brick, cast iron and Roman cement. Colours were rich and distinguished, black, biscuit, purple brown, bronze green. Texture was oak graining, wallpaper, Brussels carpets, sparkling cut glass and heavy mahogany. The sweet stale fragrance of horsehair lingered heavily in its rooms. William IV kicked off on Regency coattails in Dublin with the buildings of architect Frederick Darley. His sober law library on Henrietta Street was precursor to his 1840s extension to the King's Inns next door, with its bulgy interiors and Dublin-made furnishings. He also devised the granite-faced ranges of New Square in Trinity College that inject a dose of 1830s Edinburgh into central Dublin. His design contemporary, Jacob Owen, architect to the Board of Works, was also a proponent of the style. His modification to and replication of Tyrone House on Marlborough Street as part of the new Model Schools complex is an early example of the severe aesthetic, followed by austere additions to the rear of the forecourts as well as alterations made to the state apartments in Dublin Castle. Its throne room, which William IV never visited, is a brilliantly Irish manifestation of the vogue. 1840s railway stations feature prominently in the fold. Houston, designed by Sancton Wood as a showy Renaissance palazzo to bookend the Liffey. Connolly, by William Dean Butler, the ultimate Italianate gawk, marooned on Amiens Street like a rejected sideboard. And Broadstone, John Skipton Mulvaney's colossus and a stupendous masterstroke of monumental architecture, evoking the romance of ancient Egypt in Phibsborough. And not to forget the domestic scene, many outwardly Georgian terraces conceal what are, in fact, William IV houses, with innovations like top-lit landings, winter gardens and frothy plasterwork, built on Rathmines Road, Leeson Street, Belvedere Place, not to mention vast tracts of stucco-iced South Dublin. Many of the city's shops also date from this time, exemplified in Dublin Civic Trust's newly restored shop house at 18 Ormond Quay Upper. Department stores too, the old Brown Thomas on Grafton Street, now a sad-for-sad retention cloaking Marks and Spencer, is a rare and beautiful surviving example of 1840s commercial design by the overlooked architect William Colbeck. Its elegant Roman cement frontage has all the hallmarks of the McAnaspey brothers, Patrick and Thomas, who specialised in festooning the brick barns of Georgian Dublin. As their trade blurb proudly declared, houses neatly fronted in every style of architecture, either in Roman, Portland or mastic cement, and ornaments of every description, modelled from the designs of the most eminent architects, in a very superior manner and on most reasonable terms. The ultimate dose of William IV Dublin is architect Isaac Farrell's former savings bank on Middle Abbey Street, better known as Dublin's latest Wetherspoons. As compact as a tea caddy, bookended by matching gate portals and entered through a Doric portico and antis, its granite facade conceals a sequence of handsome interiors that culminate in a grand stair. A cast iron balustrade leads to the cavernous first floor office with coffered ceiling and one of Dublin's very best chimney piece and great ensembles in jet black livery. Sober William IV pulses through its veins like beer through its bar taps. Next time you're wandering through town, take off those Georgian tinted glasses and devour the madness of that other Williamite campaign.
One of the bitterest rows my mother and I ever had centred around windows. It happened on her regular walk near the family home in rural Galway, a lonely road that skirts a raised bog. I was down from Dublin for the weekend. That day we passed an excavator demolishing a stone cottage which had been empty for years. The gable wall collapsed gently, like an old person stumbling. In the adjacent field rose up an enormous five-bedroom dormer with the tarmac drive and clipped lawns. I pointed to the remains of the old sash windows piled in the skip. "Nobody round here has a clue," I said. She was livid with me, my condescending tone. "Do you want us living in the last century?" she said. "In the cold and damp?" It was a stupid, vicious argument. I walked on alone. When I turned at the head of the road, I looked back at her, a small figure, head down in the wind. Like many people, my mother's relationship with her environment, built or natural, was conflicted and often contradictory. She was born in 1937 in a thatched cottage with no running water. Although her family benefited from the state housing and rural electrification schemes, and despite a deeply felt emotional connection to her home, my mother didn't forget the chilblains in winter and the lack of what she called nice things. She hadn't planned to end up back in rural Galway. My parents had met and married in England, and it was unexpected life circumstances that resulted in them building a bungalow right beside my mother's childhood home in the late 1970s. The lush, mature gardens and picturesque villages of the south of England had shaped my young mother's aesthetic ideals, and she hadn't much time for the stone walls and the flat, bog-ridden farmland of northeast Galway. Back in a 1970s rural Ireland, hell-bent on modernisation, formica and PVC being all the rage, she insisted on timber windows in her newly built house and argued with the council about road frontage. Why couldn't the house be built at an angle to the road? I remember helping her pull aside bales of hay in the shed, trying to find an old wall clock that had been left to rot. In the garden, she battled with the moss and the stony soil, aiming for an English country cottage look, an abundance of peonies, narcissus and wallflowers that never really flourished as she would have liked, but did survive, eventually mingling with the pale lilac rocket and wild woodbine that migrated in from the surrounding hedgerows. She was scathing about the columns, balconies and cladding that adorned so many other bungalows of the era, but equally had no truck with minimalism either, or what she referred to as modern design. I have a memory of her on the way home from a day trip to Clifton, driving through the Mam Valley with its lunar landscape, the desolation of which made me feel slightly queasy. She was giving out about an architect-designed concrete new build we had passed. "Brutal, sticks out like a sore thumb," was her verdict. Years later, battling with an architect over my own house, I recalled the sore thumb comment. For many people, including my mother, houses are not a manifestation of a connection to their surroundings, but more like a denial of where they are and who they are. We build what we want to become: warmer, grander, richer, more sophisticated. At the end of her life, as she grew frail, my mother would sometimes ask me to drive her places she hadn't been to in years. She provided a running commentary on the land and how it had changed, the houses, the families who had built them. On one of her final trips out, she directed me down a small road near the bog. The road narrowed to a rough track and became impassable for the car. I linked her and we walked past a small plantation of Scots pine to where the space opened into a large farmyard with outhouses and an imposing two-storey house. It was in relatively good condition, the roof largely intact, the windows unbroken. The front door was secured with bright blue baling twine. I pushed the rusted gate, but uneven ground made her nervous. She went no further. I left her leaning on her stick and undid the knot of blue twine. Parts of the ceilings and stairs had collapsed, so I didn't progress beyond the hall. But in the dim, I saw remnants of a finely carved dado rail, Bakelite switches, scraps of patterned wallpaper, and a broken-down dresser that someone, once, had taken the time and care to paint mint green. We lingered at the gate. Beyond the house, the open stretch of raised bog glowed in a sudden burst of late afternoon sun. There was honeysuckle and gorse amid the purplish moor grass and flurries of bog cotton. It was as if she was seeing the scene for the first time. "It is," she said, "spectacular."
When my feet were still forming and my wits were just beginning, I heard of Dublin and I would gasp. When childhood teeth were still milky and my eyes were heavy with school books, fingers following lines to be read, schoolgirl charm still developing, when pen was still approaching paper, timid and unsure, I heard of Dublin. When train rides were still adventures and train tracks carried you to more than a destination, when metal bullet tanks took people at the speed of whatever was less than light, I heard of Dublin. When permissions were something sought from every adult with wisdom wicks lined around their eyes, when life was something vertically leaning, looking up to light grey fluffing heads, I followed and obeyed. When dreams were something I took from sleep and wonder was anything found on the internet, I heard of Dublin. When Dublin was the home of every grand decision my mother had to comply with, when her hands shook with letters she interpreted in friendship groups, they arrived from Dublin. When the hallways hushed with contemplation amongst family members, the answers were always in Dublin. When my rewards were sweetest, they took me to Dublin, shopping centres, buildings tall and fat and thick and old and fun engulfed in Bambi feet. Everything towered in Dublin. Everything spun in Dublin. everything mystified and demystified in Dublin. The spire called all of us, every friend and I, to claim it as our centre, our starting point, our remembrance spot, our forget-me-not, our find-me-here, our saving grace, our on-your-marks, get-set, our go. I met Dublin properly, wide-eyed, the big city the country girl couldn't capture in a stare. I spent time with Dublin like a guest. I hid in its outskirts and took to it when I sought answers, when letters were complex, when poetry asked me to stretch, when job interviews were up next. I took to Dublin with much respect, and it tossed me sometimes. It humoured me sometimes. It allowed me to swallow street names with time, charmed me into recognising the best place to get the best this, the best that happened here. The only place to get this belonged here. I finger-pointed actuallys to guests who hadn't met Dublin at all. I knew Dublin like the family friend you end up calling cousin. Close enough, just about. Dublin and I could be merry when we met, and I didn't have to watch my bags around Dublin. I didn't have to watch myself in Dublin. I didn't have to use my inside voice around Dublin. I didn't even always have to have enough coins and wherewithal for Dublin to take me as I am, and Dublin would happily take. But me too, I was happy for Dublin to take, phone or otherwise. I knew Dublin well enough at this stage. We bumped shoulders and then we would wink at each other. It was harmless. For a long time, Dublin's sharp teeth never sharpened in my direction. The lion only tears away at the bastard child in his pride. My milk teeth had spat here. My Bambi feet had run here. My awe had gasped outside Connolly Station. My adult hands had toiled here. I even lived here. Tram lines through neighbourhoods on tracks I watched be built. I knew Dublin. I knew Dublin so well till I didn't. I saw Dublin till it blurred my vision. I could say her name and not have to whisper. Now I am hoarse. Dublin has become my boogeyman. I stare at Dublin and want to cradle her. Dublin slaps my hands away. Dublin slaps many hands away. COVID took her beauty and textured her skin with men in need of alms. The ones Dublin couldn't feed, couldn't save. Dublin is heaving with the unremembered, determined to be seen. Dublin is shaking with the memory of safety now out of reach. Dublin is throwing out its own children, sending them away. Dublin keeps telling all of us, I have no more space. Dublin cannot hold any of her own softly anymore. Dublin is making us hard. Dublin is making us scared. Dublin is closing doors that took art in. It is spitting coffee beans at us, faxing us hotel receipts, HQs and HQs without so much as a father in their names. Dublin has been through worse before we came. Dublin will go through better when we leave.